This is Audible.
Books on Tape presents The Nanny Diaries by Emma McLaughlin and Nicola Krauss. Read by Kata Mazur. A note to readers. The authors have worked, at one time or another, for over 30 New York City families, and this story was inspired by what they have learned and experienced. However, The Nanny Diaries is a work of fiction, and none of those families is portrayed in this book. Names and characters are the product of the author's imagination. Any resemblance to actual events or persons, living or dead, is coincidental, although some real New York City institutions, schools, stores, galleries, and the like, are mentioned, all are used fictitiously. You should hear Mama on the chapter of governesses. Mary and I have had, I should think, a dozen at least in our day, half of them detestable and the rest ridiculous, and all incubi, were they not, Mama? My dearest, don't mention governesses. The word makes me nervous. I have suffered a martyrdom from their incompetency and caprice. I thank heaven I have now done with them. Jane Eyre. Prologue. The Interview. Every season of my nanny career kicked off with a round of interviews so surreally similar that I'd often wonder if the mothers were slipped a secret manual at the Parents' League to guide them through. This initial encounter became as repetitive as religious ritual, tempting me in the moment before the front door swung open, either to kneel and genuflect or say, "Hit it!" No other event epitomized the job as perfectly, and it always began and ended in an elevator nicer than most New Yorkers' apartments. The walnut-paneled car slowly pulls me up, like a bucket in a well, toward potential solvency. As I near the appointed floor, I take a deep breath. The door slides open onto a small vestibule, which is the portal to, at most, two apartments. I press the doorbell. Nanny fact. She always waits for me to ring the doorbell, even though she was buzzed by maximum security downstairs to warn of my imminent arrival and is probably standing on the other side of the door. May, in fact, have been standing there since we spoke on the telephone 3 days ago. The dark vestibule, wallpapered in some gloomy Colfax and Fowler floral, always contains a brass umbrella stand, a horse print, and a mirror, wherein I do one last swift check of my appearance. I seem to have grown stains on my skirt during the train ride from school, but otherwise I'm pulled together. Twin set, floral skirt, and some Gucci knockoff sandals I bought in the village. She is always tiny. Her hair is always straight and thin. She always seems to be inhaling and never exhaling. She is always wearing expensive khaki pants, Chanel ballet flats, a French-striped t-shirt, and a white cardigan. Possibly some discreet pearls. In 7 years and umpteen interviews, the I'm mom casual in my khakis but intimidating in my $400 shoes outfit never changes. And it is simply impossible to imagine her doing anything so undignified as what was required to get her pregnant in the first place. Her eyes go directly to the splot on my skirt. I blush. I haven't even opened my mouth, and already I'm behind. She ushers me into the front hall, an open space with a gleaming marble floor and mushroom gray walls. In the middle is a round table with a vase of flowers that look as if they might die but never dare wilt. This is my first impression of the apartment, and it strikes me like a hotel suite, immaculate but impersonal. Even the lone finger painting I will later find taped to the fridge looks as if it were ordered from a catalog. Sub-zeros with a custom-colored panel aren't magnetized. She offers to take my cardigan, stares disdainfully at the hair my cat seems to have rubbed on it for good luck, and offers me a drink. I'm supposed to say, "Water would be lovely," but am often tempted to ask for a scotch, just to see what she'd do. I am then invited into the living room, which varies from baronial splendor to Ethan Allen interchangeable, depending on how old the money is. She gestures me to the couch, where I promptly sink 3 feet into the cushions, transformed into a 5-year-old dwarfed by mountains of chintz. She looms above me, ramrod straight in a very uncomfortable-looking chair, legs crossed, tight smile. Now we begin the actual interview. I awkwardly place my sweating glass of water carefully on a coaster that looks as if it could use a coaster. She is clearly reeling with pleasure at my sheer Caucasianness. "So," she begins brightly, "how did you come to the Parents League?" This is the only part of the interview that resembles a professional exchange. We will dance around certain words, such as nanny and childcare, because they would be distasteful, and we will never, ever actually acknowledge that we are talking about my working for her. This is the holy covenant of the mother-nanny relationship. This is a pleasure, not a job. We are merely getting to know each other, much as how I imagine a John and a call girl must make the deal while trying not to kill the mood. The closest we get to the possibility that I might actually be doing this for money is the topic of my babysitting experience, which I describe as a passionate hobby, much like raising seeing-eye dogs for the blind. As the conversation progresses, I become a child development expert, convincing both of us of my desire to fulfill my very soul by raising a child and taking part in all stages of his/her development. A simple trip to the park or museum becoming a precious journey of the heart. I cite amusing anecdotes from past gigs, referring to the children by name. I still marvel at the cognitive growth of Constance with each hour we spent together in the sandbox. I feel my eyes twinkle and imagine twirling my umbrella a la Mary Poppins. We both sit in silence for a moment, picturing my studio apartment crowded with framed finger paintings and my doctorates from Stanford. She stares at me expectantly, ready for me to bring it on home. I love children. I love little hands and little shoes and peanut butter sandwiches and peanut butter in my hair and Elmo. I love Elmo. And sand in my purse and the Hokey Pokey. Can't get enough of it. And soy milk and blankies and the endless barrage of questions no one knows the answers to. I mean, why is the sky blue? And Disney? Disney is my second language. We can both hear a whole new world slowly swelling in the background as I earnestly convey that it would be more than a privilege to take care of her child. It would be an adventure. She is flushed, but still playing it close to the chest. Now she wants to know why, if I'm so fabulous, I would want to take care of her child. I mean, she gave birth to it, and she doesn't want to do it, so why would I? Am I trying to pay off an abortion? Fund a leftist group? How did she get this lucky? She wants to know what I study, what I plan to do in the future, what I think of private schools in Manhattan, what my parents do. I answer with as much filigree and insouciance as I can muster, trying to slightly cock my head like Snow White listening to the animals. She, in turn, is aiming for more of a Diane Sawyer pose, looking for answers which will confirm that I am not there to steal her husband, jewelry, friends, or child. In that order. Nanny fact. In every one of my interviews, references are never checked. I am white. I speak French. My parents are college-educated. I have no visible piercings and have been to Lincoln Center in the last 2 months. I'm hired. She stands with newfound hope. Let me show you around. Although we've already met, it's time for the apartment to play its role to full effect. As we pass through each room, it seems to fluff itself and shimmy to add shine to the already blinding surfaces. Touring is what this apartment was born for. Each enormous room leads to the next with a few mini hallways just big enough for a framed original so-and-so. No matter if she has an infant or a teenager, there is never a trace of a child to be found on the tour. In fact, there's never a trace of anyone. Not a single family picture displayed. I'll find out later that these are all discreetly tucked into sterling Tiffany frames and clustered artfully in a corner of the den. Somehow, the absence of a pair of strewn shoes or an opened envelope makes it hard to believe that the scene I am being led through is three-dimensional. It seems like a Potemkin apartment. I consequently feel ungainly and unsure of how to demonstrate the appropriate awe that is expected from me without saying, "Yes'm, it's all so awfully loverly, sure is." in a thick Cockney accent and curtsying. Luckily, she is in perpetual motion and the opportunity does not present itself. She glides silently ahead of me, and I'm struck by how tiny her frame seems against the dense furnishings. I stare at her back as she moves from room to room, stopping only briefly in each to wave her hand around in a circle and say the room's name, to which I nod to confirm that this is, in fact, the dining room. Two pieces of information are meant to be conveyed to me during the tour. One, I am out of my league, and two, I will be policing at maximum security to ensure that her child, who is also out of his or her league, does not scuff, snag, spill, or spoil a single element of this apartment. The coded script for this exchange goes as follows. She turns around to mention that there really is no housekeeping involved, and that Hutchison really prefers to play in his room. If there were any justice in the world, this is the point when all nannies should be given roadblocks and a stun gun. These rooms are destined to become the burden of my existence. From this point on, 95% of this apartment will be nothing more than a blurred background for chasing, enticing, and point-blank pleading with the child to put the Delft milkmaid down! I am also about to become intimate with more types of cleaning fluid than I knew there were types of dirt. It will be in her pantry, stocked high above the washer-dryer, that I discover people actually import toilet bowl cleanser from Europe. We arrive in the kitchen. It is enormous. With a few partitions, it could easily house a family of four. She stops to rest one manicured hand on the counter, affecting a familiar pose, like a captain at the helm about to address the crew. However, I know if I asked her where she keeps the flour, a half hour of rummaging through unused baking utensils would ensue. Nanny fact. She may pour an awful lot of Perrier in this kitchen, but she never actually eats here. In fact, over the course of the job, I never see her eat anything. While she can't tell me where to find the flour, she can probably locate the laxatives in her medicine cabinet blindfolded. The refrigerator is always bursting with tons of meticulously chopped fresh fruit separated into Tupperware bowls and at least two packs of fresh cheese tortellini that her child prefers without sauce. Meaning there is never any in the house for me, either. There is also the requisite organic milk, a deserted bottle of Lillet, and Sarah Beth's jam, and lots of refrigerated ginkgo biloba for Daddy's memory. The freezer is stocked with Mommy's dirty little secret, chicken nuggets and popsicles. As I peer into the fridge, I see that food is for the child. Condiments are for the grown-ups. One pictures a family meal in which parents meekly stick toothpicks into a jar of Grace's sun-dried tomatoes while child gorges on a feast of fresh fruit and frozen dinners. Branford's meals are really quite simple, she says, gesturing to the frozen food as she closes the freezer door. Translation. They're able to feed him this crap in good conscience on the weekends because I will be cooking him four-course macrobiotic meals on the weeknights. There will be a day to come when I stare at the colorful packages in the freezer with raw envy as I re-steam the wild rice from Costa Rica for the four-year-old's maximum digestive ease. She swings open the pantry, which is big enough to be a summer home for the family of four who could live in the kitchen, to reveal an Armageddon-ready level of storage, as if the city were in perpetual danger of being looted by a roving band of insanely health-conscious five-year-olds. It is overflowing with every type of juice box, soy milk, rice milk, organic pretzel, organic granola bar, and organic raisin the consulted nutritionist could think up. The only item with additives is a shelf of goldfish options, including low salt and the not-so-popular onion. There isn't a single trace of food in the entire kitchen big enough to fill a grown-up hand. Despite the myth of help yourself, it will take a few starving evenings of raisin dinners before I discover the top shelf, which appears to be trip-wired and covered with dust, but contains the much-coveted gourmet house gifts that have been left for dead by women who see chocolate as a grenade in Pandora's box. Barney's Raisinettes, truffles from Saks, fudge from Martha's Vineyard, all of which I devour like crack cocaine in the bathroom to avoid the crime being recorded by a possible security camera. I picture the footage being played on hard copy. Nanny caught in the act. Hetty, with delusions of entitlement, breaks cellophane wrapper on 92 Easter Godivas. It is at this point that she begins the rules. This is a very pleasing portion of the event for any mother, because it is a chance to demonstrate how much thought and effort has gone into bringing the child this far. She speaks with a rare mixture of animation, confidence, and awesome conviction. She knows this much is true. I, in turn, adopt my most eager yet compassionate expression, as if to say, "Yes, please, tell me more, I'm fascinated." And, "How awful it must be for you to have a child allergic to air." So begins the list. Allergic to dairy, allergic to peanuts, allergic to strawberries, allergic to propane-based shellac, some kind of grain, won't eat blueberries, will only eat blueberries, sliced. Sandwiches must be cut horizontally and have crusts. Sandwiches must be cut in quarters and have no crusts. Sandwiches must be made facing east. She loves rice milk. He won't eat anything starting with the letter M. All servings are to be pre-measured. No additional food is permissible. All juice is to be watered down and drunk out of a sip glass over the sink or in the bathtub, preferably until the child is 18. All food is to be served on a plastic placemat with paper towel beneath bowl, bib on, at all times. Actually, if you could get Lucienne naked before eating and then hose her down afterward, that would be perfect. No food or drink within 2 hours of bedtime, no additives, no preservatives, no pumpkin seeds, no skins of any kind, no raw food, no cooked food, no American food. And, voice drops to a pitch only whales can hear, no food outside the kitchen. I am nodding gravely in agreement. This makes total sense. Oh my God, of course, I find myself saying. This is phase one of bringing me into the fold, of creating the illusion of collusion. We're in this together. Little Elspeth is our joint project, and we are going to feed her nothing but mung beans. I feel as if I am 9 months pregnant and just finding out how my husband plans to raise the child in a cult. Yet I am somehow flattered that I am being chosen to participate in this project. Completion phase two. I am succumbing to the allure of perfection. The tour proceeds to the farthest possible room. The distance of the child's room from the parent's room always runs the gamut from far away to really, really far away. In fact, if there is another floor, this room will be on it. One has the image of the poor 3-year-old awakening from a nightmare and having to don a pith helmet and flashlight to go in search of her parents' room, armed only with a compass and fierce determination. The other telltale sign that one is moving into the child zone is the change in the decor from muted, faux Asian to either a Mondrian scheme of primary colors or Bon Point Kennedy pastels. Either way, Martha has been here, personally. But the effect is oddly disquieting. It's so obviously an adult's conception of a child's room, as evidenced by the fact that all the signed first edition Babar prints are hung at least 3 feet above the child's head. After having received the rules, I am braced to meet the boy in the bubble. I expect to see a full-out intensive care unit complete with a Louis Vuitton IV hookup. Imagine my shock at the ball of motion that comes hurtling across the room at us. If it's a boy, the movement is reminiscent of the Tasmanian devil, while a girl tends toward a full-tilt mousketeer sequence complete with two pirouettes and a grand jeté. The child is sent into this routine by some Pavlovian response to the mother's perfume as she rounds the corner. The encounter proceeds as follows. 1. Child, groomed within an inch of his/her life, makes a beeline directly for mother's leg. 2. At the precise moment the child's hands wrap around her thigh, the mother swiftly grabs the child's wrists. 3. And she simultaneously sidesteps out of the embrace, bringing the child's hands into a clapping position in front of the child's face, and bends down to say hello, turning the child's gaze to me. Voila. and thus the first of many performances of what I like to call the spatula reflex. It has such timing and grace that I feel as if I should applaud, but instead move directly into my Pavlovian response set off by their expectant faces. I drop to my knees. Why don't you two get to know each other a little? This is the cue for the play with child portion of the audition. Despite the fact that we all know the child's opinion is irrelevant, I nevertheless become psychotically animated. I play as if I'm Christmas and then some, until the child has been whipped into a foaming frenzy of interaction with the added stimulant of a rare audience with mother. The child has been trained in the Montessori approach to fun. Only one toy is pulled from its walnut cubicle at a time. I overcompensate for the lack of normal childhood chaos by turning into a chorus of voices, dance steps, and an in-depth understanding of Pokemon. Within moments, the child is asking me to go to the zoo, sleep over, and move in. This is the mother's cue to break in from where she has been sitting with her mental clipboard and Olympic scorecards on the edge of the child's bed to announce that it is time to say goodbye to Nanny. Won't it be fun to play with Nanny again? The housekeeper, who has been folded into a child-sized rocking chair in the corner this entire time, offers up a dejected storybook, making a meek attempt to match my display of fireworks and delay the inevitable crash. Within seconds, there is a replay of a slightly more sophisticated version of the spatula reflex, this time encompassing a maneuvering of both mother and myself outside the room, punctuated by a slammed door, all in one seamless motion. She runs her hands through her hair as she leads me back into the silence of the apartment with a long, breathy, "Well." She hands me my purse, and then I stand with her in the foyer for at least half an hour, waiting to be dismissed. "So, do you have a boyfriend?" This is the cue for the play with mother portion of the audition. She's in for the night. There is no mention of a husband's imminent arrival or plans for dinner. I hear about her pregnancy, Lottie Burke, the last parents' night meeting, the pain-in-the-ass housekeeper, left for dead in the child zone, the wily decorator, the string of nanny disasters before me, and the nursery school nightmare. Completion phase 3. I am actually excited that I am not only getting a delightful child to play with, I'm getting a new best friend. Not to be outdone, I hear myself talking, trying to establish my status as a person of the world. I name drop, brand drop, place drop, then self-consciously deprecate myself with humor so as not to intimidate her. I become aware that I am talking way, way too much. I am babbling about why I left Brown, why I left my last relationship. Not that I'm a leaver. No, no, no. I pick something. I stick with it. Yes, siree. Did I tell you about my thesis? I am revealing information that will be dragged up repeatedly for months in awkward attempts to make conversation. Soon I am just bobbing my head and saying, "Okay," while blindly groping for the doorknob. Finally, she thanks me for coming, opens the door, and lets me press for the elevator. I am caught mid-sentence as the elevator door starts to close, forcing me to shove my bag in front of the electronic eye so I can finish a meaningful thought on my parents' marriage. We smile and nod at one another like animatrons until the door mercifully slides closed. I collapse against it, exhaling for the first time in an hour. Minutes later, the subway barrels down Lexington, propelling me toward school and back to the grind of my own life. I slump against the plastic seat, images from the pristine apartment swimming in my head. These snapshots are soon interrupted by a man or woman, sometimes both, shuffling through the car begging for change while gripping their worldly possessions in a shredded shopping bag. Pulling my backpack up onto my lap, my post-performance adrenaline leveling out, questions begin to percolate. Just how does an intelligent adult woman become someone whose whole sterile kingdom has been reduced to alphabetized lingerie drawers and imported French dairy substitutes? Where is the child in this home? Where is the woman in this mother? And how exactly am I to fit in? Ultimately, there would come a turning point in every job where it seemed that the child and I were the only three-dimensional people running around on the black-and-white marble chessboards of those apartments, making it inevitable that someone would get knocked down. Looking back, It was a setup to begin with. They want you, you want the job, but to do it well is to lose it. Hit it. Part 1. Fall. Then, with a long, loud sniff that seemed to indicate that she had made up her mind, she said, "I'll take the position." For all the world, as Mrs. Banks said to her husband later, as though she were doing us an honor. Mary Poppins. Chapter 1. Nanny for Sale. "Hi, this is Alexis at the Parents League. I'm just calling to follow up on the uniform guidelines we sent over." The blonde woman volunteering behind the reception desk holds up a bejeweled finger, signaling me to wait while she continues on the phone. "Yes, well, this year we'd really like to see all your girls in longer skirts, at least 20 inches. We're still getting complaints from the mothers at the boys' schools in the vicinity." "Great. Good to hear it. Bye." With a grand gesture, she crosses the word Spence off her list of 3 items. She returns her attention to me. "I'm sorry to keep you waiting. With the school year starting, we're just crazed." She draws a big circle around the second item on her list, paper towels. "Can I help you?" "I'm here to put up an ad for a nanny, but the bulletin board seems to have moved," I say, slightly confused as I've been advertising here since I was 13. "We had to take it down while the foyer was being painted and never got around to moving it back. Here, let me show you." She leads me to the central room, where mothers perch at knoll desks, fielding inquiries about the private schools. Before me sits the full range of Upper East Side diversity. Half of the women are dressed in Chanel suits and Manolo Blahniks, half are in $600 barn jackets, looking as if they might be asked to pitch an aqua scutum tent at any moment. Alexis gestures to the bulletin board, which has displaced a Mary Cassatt propped against the wall. "It's all a bit disorganized at the moment," she says, as another woman looks up from the floral arrangement she's rearranging nearby. "But don't worry. Tons of lovely girls come here to look for employment, so you shouldn't have any trouble finding someone." She raises her hand to her pearls. "Don't you have a son at Buckley? You look so familiar. I'm Alexis." "Hi," I say. "I'm Nan. Actually, I took care of the Gleason girls. I think they lived next door to you." She arches an eyebrow to give me a once-over. Oh, nanny, that's right," she confirms for herself before retreating back to her desk. I tune out the officious, creamy chatter of the women behind me to read the postings put up by other nannies also in search of employment. "Babysitter need children. Very like kids. Vacuums. I look your kids. Many years work. You call me." The bulletin board is already so overcrowded with flyers that with a twinge of guilt, I end up tacking my ad over someone else's pink paper festooned with crayon flowers, but spend a few minutes ensuring that I'm only covering daisies and none of her pertinent information. I wish I could tell these women that the secret to nanny advertising isn't the decoration, it's the punctuation. It's all in the exclamation mark. While my ad is a minimalist 3x5 card without so much as a smiley face on it, I liberally sprinkle my advertisement with exclamations, ending each of my desirable traits with the promise of a beaming smile and unflagging positivity. "Nanny at the ready. Chapin School alumna available weekdays part-time. Excellent references. Child development major at NYU. The only thing I don't have is an umbrella that makes me fly. I do one last quick check for spelling, zip up my backpack, bid Alexis adieu, and jog down the marble steps out into the sweltering heat. As I walk down Park Avenue, the August sun is still low enough in the sky that the stroller parade is in full throttle. I pass many hot little people, looking resignedly uncomfortable in their sticky seats. They are too hot even to hold on to any of their usual traveling companions. Blankies and bears are tucked into back stroller pockets. I chuckle to myself at the child who waves away the offer of a juice box with a flick of the hand and a toss of the head that says, "I couldn't possibly be bothered with juice right now." Waiting at a red light, I look up at the large glass windows that are the eyes of Park Avenue. From a population density point of view, This is the Midwest of Manhattan. Towering above me are rooms, rooms and rooms and rooms, and they're empty. There are powder rooms and dressing rooms and piano rooms and guest rooms, and somewhere above me, but I won't say where, a rabbit named Arthur has 16 feet square all to himself. I cut across 72nd Street, passing under the shade of the blue awnings of the Polo Mansion, and turn into Central Park. Pausing in front of the playground, where a few tenacious children are trying their best despite the heat, I reach in my backpack for a small bottle of water, just as something crashes into my legs. I look down and steady the offending object, an old-fashioned wooden hoop. "Hey, that's mine!" A small boy of about 4 or so careens down the hill from where I see he's been posing for a portrait with his parents. His sailor hat topples off into the patchy grass as he runs. "That's my hoop," he announces. "Are you sure?" I ask. He looks perplexed. "It could be a wagon wheel." I hold it sideways. "Or a halo." I hold it above his blonde head. "Or a really large pizza." I hold it out to him, gesturing that he can take it. He's smiling broadly at me as he grasps it in his hands. "You silly." He drags it back up the hill, passing his mother as she strolls down to retrieve the hat. "I'm sorry," she says, brushing dust off the striped brim as she approaches me. "I hope he didn't bother you." She holds her hand out to block the sun from her pale blue eyes. "No, not at all." "Oh, but your skirt," she glances down. "No big deal," I laugh, dusting off the mark the hoop left on the fabric. "I work with kids, so I'm used to being banged up."
"Oh, you do?"
She angles her body so her back is to her husband and a blonde woman who stands off to the side of the photographer holding a juice box for the boy, his nanny, I presume. "Around here?" "Actually, the family moved to London over the summer, so..."
"We're ready,"
the father calls impatiently.
"Coming,"
she calls back brightly. She turns to me, tilting her delicately featured face away from him. She lowers her voice. "Well, we're actually looking for someone who might want to help us out part-time."
"Really? Part-time would be great, because I have a full course load this semester.
What's the best way to reach you?" I rummage through my backpack for a pen and a scrap of notebook on which I can scribble down my information. "Here you go." I pass her the paper, and she discreetly slips it in the pocket of her shift before adjusting the headband in her long, dark hair. "Wonderful," she smiles graciously. "Well, it was a pleasure to meet you. I'll be in touch." She takes a few steps up the hill and then turns around. "Oh, how silly of me. I'm Mrs. X." I return the smile before she goes back to take her place in the contrived tableau. The sun filters through the leaves, creating dappled sunshine on the three figures. Her husband, in a white seersucker suit, stands squarely in the middle, his hand on the boy's head as she slides in beside them. The blonde woman steps forward with a comb and the little boy waves to me, causing her to turn and follow his gaze. As she shields her eyes to get a better look at me, I turn and continue on my way across the park. My grandmother greets me in her entryway in a linen Mao Tse-tung outfit and pearls.
"Darling, come in. I was just finishing my Tai Chi."
She gives me a kiss on both cheeks and a solid hug for good measure.
"Honey, you're damp. Would you like to shower?"
There's nothing better than being offered Grandma's buffet of amenities. Maybe just a cold washcloth.
"I know what you need."
She takes my hand, weaving her fingers through mine, and leads me to her guest powder room. I've always adored how the small lights of the antique crystal chandelier illumine the rich peach chintz, but my favorite part is the framed French paper dolls. When I was little, I would set up a salon under the sink, for which Grandma would provide real tea and topics for the discussions I would lead with all my lovely French guests. She places my hands under the faucet and runs cool water over my wrists.
"Pressure points for distributing fire," she says, as she sits down on the toilet seat, crossing her legs.
She's right. I begin to cool down immediately.
"Have you eaten?" she asks.
"I had breakfast."
"What about lunch?"
"It's only 11, Gran."
"Is it? I've been up since 4. Thank God for Europe, or I'd have no one to talk to till 8.
I smile.
How have you been?
I've been 74 for 2 months. That's how I've been.
She points her toes like a dancer and slightly lifts the hem of her pants.
It's called Sappho. I had it done at Arden's this morning. What do you think? Tutu?
She wiggles her coral toes.
Gorgeous. Very sexy. Okay, as much as I would love to spend the rest of the day in here, I've got to drag myself downtown and make my offering to the tuition gods.
I turn off the sink and shake my hands dramatically over the basin. She hands me a towel.
You know, I don't remember having a single conversation like the ones you describe when I was at Vassar.
She's referring to my endless history of tete-a-tetes with the administrative staff at NYU. I follow behind her into the kitchen.
Today, I'm prepared. I've got my social security card, my driver's license, my passport, a Xerox copy of my birth certificate, every piece of mail I've ever received from NYU, and my letter of acceptance. This time, I won't be told I don't go there, haven't completed the last semester, haven't paid my tuition from last year, haven't paid my library fees, don't have the correct ID number, social security number, proof of my address, the right forms, or simply don't exist.
My, my, my. She opens the fridge.
Bourbon?
Orange juice would be great.
Kids!
She rolls her eyes and points me to her old air conditioner sitting on the floor.
Darling, let me get the doorman to help you carry it.
No, Gran, I got it,
I say, trying valiantly to heave the machine into my arms before slamming it back down on the tile.
Yeah, okay. I think I'm going to have to come back later with Josh and get this.
Joshua? She asks with a raised eyebrow. Your little blue-haired friend? He weighs 5 pounds soaking wet.
Well, unless we want Dad throwing his back out again, that's about all I have to choose from in the boy department.
I chant for you every morning, darling, she says, reaching for a glass.
Come on, let me whip you up some eggs, Benedict.
I glance up at the old Nelson wall clock. I wish I had time, but I've got to get downtown before the line at the registrar's around the block. She gives me a kiss on both cheeks.
Well, then bring that Joshua by at 7 and I'll feed you both a proper meal. You're disappearing.
Josh groans and rolls slowly onto his back from where he has nearly blacked out after dropping the air conditioner outside my front door.
You lied to me, he wheezes. You said it was on the 3rd floor.
Yeah,
I say, shaking out my lower arms while leaning back against the top stair. He lifts his head an inch off the floor.
Nan, that was 6 flights. 2 flights a floor, which makes this technically like the 6th floor.
You helped me move out of the dorm.
Yeah, why was that?
Oh, right, because it has an elevator.
Well, the good news is that I'm not planning on moving out of here ever. This is it. You can visit me up here when we're old and gray.
I wipe the sweat off my forehead.
Forget it. I'll be hanging out on your front stoop with the rest of the blue hairs.
He drops his head back down.
Come on, I pull myself up by the banister. Cold beers await.
I unlock all 3 locks and open the door. The apartment feels like a car that's been sitting in the hot sun, and we have to step back to let the scorching air blow past us into the hallway.
Charlene must have closed the windows before she left this morning, I say.
And left the oven on. He adds, stepping behind me into the tiny entryway that also does double duty as a kitchen.
Welcome to my fully equipped closet. Can I toast you a bagel?
I drop my keys next to the 2-burner stove.
What are you paying for this place? He asks.
You don't want to know, I say as we push the air conditioner across the room together in little shoves.
So, where's the hot roommate? He asks.
Josh, not all stewardesses are hot. Some are the matronly type.
Is she?
He stops.
Don't stop.
We resume pushing.
No. She's hot, but I don't like you assuming she's hot.
She flew to France or Spain or something this morning. I huff as we round the corner to my end of the L-shaped studio.
George! Josh cries out in greeting to my cat, who sprawled out on the warm wooden floor in despair.
He lifts his gray furry head 1/2 inch and meows plaintively.
Josh straightens up and wipes his forehead with the bottom of his Mr. Bubble t-shirt.
Where do you want this sucker?
I point to the top of the window.
What?
You a crazy lady.
It's a trick I learned on the Avenue so as not to interfere with the view.
Those without central air go to great lengths to hide it, darling, I explain as I kick off my sandals.
What view?
If you smush your face against the window and look left, you can see the river.
Hey, you're right, he pulls back from the glass.
Listen, this whole Josh heaving heavy machinery up to balance on sheet of glass thing, not gonna happen, Nan. I'm getting a beer. Come on, George.
He heads back to the kitchen, and George stretches up to follow him.
I use the moment alone to grab a clean tank top out of an open box and pull off my sweaty one. As I crouch behind the boxes to change, I catch sight of the red light from my answering machine blinking in a frenzy from the floor. The word full glares up at me.
Running that 900 number again? Josh reaches over the box to hand me a Corona.
Practically. I put my ad up for a new position today and the mummies are restless. I take a swig of my beer and slide down between the boxes to hit play. A woman's voice fills the room.
Hi, this is Mimi Van Owen. I saw your ad at the League. I'm looking for someone to help me look after my son. Just part-time, you understand. Maybe 2, 3, 4 days a week, half days or longer, and some nights or weekends or both, whenever you have time. But I just want you to know that I'm very involved.
Well, that's just obvious, Mimi, Josh says, sliding down to join me.
Hi, this is Ann Smith. I'm looking for someone to watch my 5-year-old son. He's no trouble, really, and we run a very relaxed household.
Ouch! Josh puts his hands up to shield himself, and I forward to the next message.
Hi, I'm Betty Potter. I saw your ad at the Parents League. I have a 5-year-old girl, Stanton, a 3-year-old boy, Tinford, a 10-month-old Jace, and I'm looking for someone who can help me since I'm pregnant again. Now, you didn't mention your fee in the ad, but I've been paying six.
Six American dollars? I ask the machine incredulously.
Hey, Betty, I know a crack whore down in Washington Square Park who'd do it for a quarter. Josh swigs his beer.
Hi, it's Mrs. X. We met in the park this morning. Give me a call when you get a chance. I'd like to talk more about the type of job you're looking for. We have a girl, Caitlin, but she's looking to cut her hours, and you made quite an impression on our son, Grayer. Look forward to talking to you. Bye.
She sounds normal. Call her.
You think? I ask as the phone rings, making us both jump. I pick up the receiver.
Hello?
I say in instant nanny mode, trying to convey utmost respectability with two syllables.
Hello? My mother matches my deep, fancy tone. How'd the air conditioner mission turn out?
Hey, I relax. Fine.
Wait, hold on.
I hear a scuffle. I have to keep moving Sophie. She's determined to sit 2 inches from the air conditioner. I smile at the image of our 14-year-old Springer Spaniel with her ears blowing out behind her like the Red Baron.
Move it, Soph.
And now she's sitting on all the research for the grant. I take a sip of beer. How's that coming?
Ugh, it's too depressing. Tell me something cheerful.
Since the Republicans took office, my mother's coalition for women's shelters gets even less money than it used to.
I got some funny messages from mummies in need, I offer.
I thought we discussed this. Her lawyer voice is back.
Nan, you take these jobs, and within days you're up at 3 in the morning worrying if the little princess has tap dancing or a jam session with the Dalai Lama. Mom, I haven't even interviewed yet.
Besides, I'm not going to be working as many hours this year because I have my thesis.
Exactly. That's exactly it. You have your thesis. Just like last year, you had your internship, and the year before that, you had your field study.
I don't understand why you won't even consider an academic job. You should ask your thesis professor if you can assist him, or you could work in the research library.
We have been over this a million times. I roll my eyes at Josh.
Those jobs are so competitive. Dr. Clarkson has a graduate student on full fellowship assisting him. Besides, they only pay $6 an hour, before taxes. Mom, nothing I do with my clothes on is going to pay this well until I get my degree.
Josh shimmies and pulls off an imaginary bra.
My mother lucked out with a research assistant position that she held on to for all 4 years of her undergraduate work. However, that was when housing near Columbia cost as much as I am currently paying for utilities. Do I have to give you the real estate talk again, Mom?
Then for the love of God, be a makeup girl at Bloomingdale's. Just punch in your time card, look pretty, smile, and get your paycheck.
She can't imagine that one would ever wake at 3 a.m. in a cold sweat, wondering if the shipment of oil-free toner had remembered to put on its nighttime pull-ups.
Mom, I enjoy working with kids. Look, it's too hot to argue.
Just promise me you'll think about it this time before you take a job. I don't want you graduating on Valium because some woman with more money than she knows what to do with left you her kid while she ran off to Cannes.
And I do think about it, while Josh and I listen to all the messages again, trying to find the mother who sounds least likely to do just that.
The following Monday, on my way to meet Mrs. X, I make a quick stop at my favorite stationery store to stock up on Post-its. Today, my Filofax only has two Post-its, a tiny pink one imploring me to buy more Post-its, and a green one reminding me that I have coffee, Mrs. X, 11:15. I pull off the pink one and toss it in the trash as I continue heading south to La Pâtisserie Goût de Moi, our appointed meeting place. As I cut across to Park, I begin passing chic women in fall suits, all holding sheets of monogrammed stationery in their bejeweled hands. Each one walks in tandem with a shorter, dark-skinned woman who nods emphatically back at them.
"Ballet! Do you understand?"
the woman next to me rudely shouts to her nodding companion as we wait for the light to change.
"On Mondays, Josefina has ballet!"
I smile sympathetically at the uniformed woman to show solidarity. No bones about it. Training just plain sucks. And it sucks significantly harder depending on who you're working for. There are essentially three types of nanny gigs. Type A. I provide couple time, a few nights a week, for people who work all day and parent most nights. Type B. I provide sanity time a few afternoons a week to a woman who mothers most days and nights. Type C, I'm brought in as one of a cast of many to collectively provide 24/7 me time to a woman who neither works nor mothers, and her days remain a mystery to us all.
"The agency said you can cook. Can you cook?"
a poochie-clad mother interrogates on the next corner. As a working mother herself, the Type A mother will relate to me as a professional and treat me with respect. She knows I've arrived to do my job, and after a thorough tour will hand me a comprehensive list of emergency numbers and skedaddle. This is the best transition a nanny can hope for. The child sobs for at most 15 minutes, and before you know it, we're bonding over Play-Doh. The Type B mother may not work in an office, but she logs enough hours with her child to recognize it for the job it is. And following an afternoon of hanging around the apartment together, her kids are all mine for the second date.
"Now the dry cleaner's number's on there, and the florist and the caterer. What about the doctor for the children?"
the Mexican woman next to me asks quietly.
"Oh, I'll get you that next week."
Suffice it to say that the quirk factor sharply increases as one moves along the spectrum from A to C. The only thing predictable about training with a Type C mother is that her pervasive insecurity forces everyone to take the longest possible route to getting in sync. I push open the heavy glass door of the pâtisserie and see Mrs. X already seated, going over her own list. She stands, revealing a lavender knee-length skirt, which perfectly matches the cardigan tied around her shoulders. No longer in her youthful white shift, she looks older than she did in the park. Despite her girlish ponytail, I'm guessing she's in her early 40s.
"Hi, Nanny. Thanks so much for meeting me early. Would you like some coffee?"
"That sounds perfect. Thank you," I say, taking a seat with my back to the wood-paneled wall and smoothing the damask napkin onto my lap.
"Waiter, another café au lait, and could you bring us a bread basket?"
"Oh, no, you don't need to do that," I say.
"Oh, no, it's the best. That way you can pick what you want."
The waiter brings over a pierre de basket, brimming with breads and little jars of jam. I help myself to a brioche. "They have the best pastry here," she says, taking a croissant. Which reminds me, I prefer that grayer stay away from refined flour.
"Of course,"
I mumble, mouth full.
"Did you have a nice weekend?"
I quickly swallow. "Sarah,
my best friend from Chapin, had a little farewell party last night before everyone goes back to school. Now it's just me and the California people, who have off till October. Tell Grayer to go to Stanford, I laugh. She smiles.
So why'd you transfer from Brown? She asks, pulling one claw off her croissant.
They had a stronger child development program at NYU, I reply, trying to tread lightly here in case I'm talking to a steadfast Brown alum, choosing not to mention the human excrement in the lounge next to my room or any other of the myriad of charming anecdotes I could share.
I really wanted to go to Brown, she says.
Oh? But I won a scholarship to UConn. She drops the croissant to play with the diamond heart dangling from her necklace.
That's great, I say, trying to imagine a time when she would have needed a scholarship to do anything.
Well, I'm from Connecticut, so... Oh, Connecticut's beautiful, I say. She glances down at her plate. Actually, it was New London, so... Well, after graduation, I moved here to run Gagosian, the art gallery. She smiles again.
Wow, that must have been amazing.
It was a lot of fun, she says, nodding. But you can't really do it when you have a child. It's a full-time life. Parties, trips, a lot of schmoozing, a lot of late nights. A woman in dark Jackie O sunglasses accidentally bumps our table as she passes, causing the china saucers to teeter precariously on the marble.
Binky?
Mrs. X asks, reaching up to touch the woman's arm as I steady the cups.
Oh my God, hi! I didn't even see you there, the woman says, lowering her dark glasses.
Her eyes are swollen and damp from crying. I'm sorry I couldn't come to Grayer's birthday party. Consuela said it was fabulous. I've been meaning to call, Mrs. X says. Is there anything I can do?
Not unless you know a hitman. She pulls a handkerchief out of her Todd's purse and blows her nose. That lawyer Gina Zuckerman recommended couldn't help at all. Turns out all our assets are actually in Mark's company's name. He's getting the apartment, the yacht, the house in East Hampton. I'm getting $400,000 flat. That's it. Mrs. X swallows and Binky continues tearfully.
And I have to supply complete receipts for every penny of child support spent. I mean, really, am I supposed to get my facials at Baby Gap?
That's appalling.
Then the judge had the nerve to tell me to go back to work.
He has no idea what it means to be a mom. None of them do, Mrs. X says, tapping her list for emphasis while I stare intently at my brioche.
If I had known he was going to go this far, I would have just turned a blind...
Binky's voice breaks, and she purses her glossy lips together to clear her throat.
Well, I've got to run. Consuela has another appointment for her hip replacement. She speaks with venom. I swear, it's the third one this month. I'm really losing patience with her.
Anyway, great to see you. She pushes her sunglasses back into place and with an air kiss disappears through the crowd awaiting tables.
Well, Mrs. X stares after her, her face locked briefly into a grimace before returning her attention to me. Well, let's just go over the week. I've typed this all up for you so you can review it later. We'll walk over to school now so Grayer can see us together and get the sense that I'm trusting you with him. That should relax him. He has a play date at 1:30, so that'll give you just enough time to have lunch in the park and yet not overwhelm him. Then tomorrow, you and Caitlin can both spend the afternoon with him, so you can get a sense of his routine and he can see the authority being shared between you. I'd appreciate it if you didn't discuss the transition with her at this point.
Of course, I say, trying to absorb it all, the brioche, the briefing, Binky. Thank you for breakfast. Oh, don't mention it, she stands, pulling a blue folder that says Nanny out of her Hermes bag and sliding it across the table. I'm so glad Tuesdays and Thursdays fit into your class schedule. I think it'll be great for Grayer to have someone young and fun to play with. I'm sure he gets tired of boring old mom.
Grayer seems great, I say, recalling his giggles in the park.
Well, he has his little things, like any kid, I suppose. I gather my bag, glancing down and noticing her lavender silk heels for the first time. God, those are beautiful. Are they Prada? I ask, recognizing the silver buckle. Oh, thank you. She turns her ankle. Yes, they are. You really like them? I nod. You don't think they're too loud? Oh, no, I say, following her out of the cafe. My best friend just had a baby, and her feet went up a whole size. She let me pick out what I wanted, but I don't know. She glances down at her shoes in consternation as we wait for the light. I guess I've just gotten used to wearing flats. No, they're great. You should definitely keep them. She smiles, delighted, as she slides on her sunglasses. Mrs. Butters, Grayer's teacher, smiles at me and shakes my hand. It's a pleasure to meet you. She looks down adoringly. You are going to love Grayer. He's a very special little boy. She pats her corduroy apron dress, which fits loosely over her puffed sleeve blouse. With her round, dimpled cheeks and plump, dimpled hands, she looks much like a 4-year-old herself. Hi, Grayer, I say, smiling down at the top of his blonde head. He's wearing a little white Oxford button-down polo shirt, untucked on one side, containing the evidence of a morning hard at work, finger paint, what looks like glue, and one lone macaroni. How was school today? Grayer, you remember Nanny. You two are going to have lunch at the playground, his mother prompts him. He slumps against her leg and glares at me. Go away! Honey, we can have snack together, but Mommy has an appointment. You two are going to have such a good time. Now hop in your stroller and Nanny will give you snack. As we approach the playground, he and I both listen attentively to the long list of Grayer's likes and dislikes. He loves the slide, but the monkey bars bore him. Don't let him pick anything up off the ground. He likes to do that. And please keep him away from the drinking fountain by the clock. What should I do if he needs to use the bathroom? Where should he go? I ask, as we pass under the dusty wooden arches of the 66th Street playground. Oh, anywhere. I'm just about to ask for a little clarification on the peeing thing when her cell phone rings. Okay, Mama's gotta go, she says, snapping her StarTAC closed. Her departure is like the suicide drills from gym class. Every time she gets just a few feet farther away, Grayer cries and she scurries back, admonishing, Now let's be a big boy. Only once Grayer is in complete hysterics does she look at her watch, and with a, Now Mommy's going to be late, is gone. We sit on the only empty bench in the shade while he sniffles and eat our sandwiches, which have some sort of vegetable spread in them, and I think un-bologna. As he raises his sleeve to wipe his nose, I notice for the first time dangling from beneath his untucked shirt tails what appears to be a business card pinned to his belt loop. I reach out. Grayer, what's with the... Hey! He swats my hand away. That's my card! It's dirty and bent and has clearly been around the block a few times, but I think I can make out Mr. X's name in faded type. Whose card is that, Grayer? You know, he pounds his forehead, exasperated by my ignorance. My card! Jeez! Push me on the swings! By the time we're done eating and I've given him a few pushes, it's time for us to walk over to his playdate. I wave as he runs into the apartment. Okay, bye, Grayer. See you tomorrow. He screeches to a halt, turns around, sticks his tongue out at me, and then runs off. Okay, have fun. I smile at the other nanny as if to say, Oh, that's just our tongue game. Once I'm on the subway to school, I pull out the blue folder, which has my pay envelope paperclipped inside. Mrs. X, 721 Park Avenue, Apartment 9B, New York, New York, 10021. Dear Nanny, Welcome! The attached is a copy of Grayer's schedule of after-school activities. Caitlin will show you the routine, but I'm sure you've been to most of these places before. Let me know if you have any questions. Thanks, Mrs. X. P.S. I've also included a list of some possible fun activities. P.P.S. I really prefer it if Grayer doesn't nap in the afternoons. I glance at the schedule, and she's right. I'm a veteran of every activity on the list. Monday, 2 to 2:45. Music lesson, Diller Quail, 95th Street between Park and Madison. Parents pay an astronomical sum for this prestigious music school where four-year-olds usually sit in stone-cold silence as their caregivers sing nursery rhymes in a circle. 5 to 5:45. Mommy and Me, 92nd Street Y on Lexington. As the name implies, mothers are expected to go. Nevertheless, half of the group is nannies. Tuesday, 4 to 5 o'clock. Swimming lesson at Asphalt Green, 90th Street and East End Avenue. One emaciated woman in a Chanel swimsuit and five nannies in muumuus, all pleading with toddlers to get in the water. Wednesday, 2 to 3 o'clock. Physical education at Cats, Park Avenue at 64th Street. Deep in the bowels of a cold, dank church that smells like feet, thoroughly choreographed games for the pint-sized athlete. 5 to 5:45. Karate, 92nd Street Y on Lexington. Kids who quake with fear do 50 push-ups on their knuckles as a warm-up, the one class daddies attend. Thursday, 2 to 2:45. Piano lesson at home with Mrs. Schrader. Music to be tortured by. 5 to 6 o'clock. French class. Alliance Française, 60th Street between Madison and Park. Standard after-school activities conducted in another language. Friday, 1 to 1:40. Ice skating, the ice studio, Lexington between 73rd and 74th. Cold as fuck and damp. Struggle through a 30-minute change of terror, sharp metal blades flying everywhere, so children can get on ice for 40 minutes and come back out to change again. I will let you know when he is scheduled for the optician, orthodontist, orthotic fittings, physical therapist, Ayurvedic practitioner. In the event of a class cancellation, the following non-structured outings are permissible: the Frick, the Met, the Guggenheim Soho, the Morgan Library, the French Culinary Institute, the Swedish Consulate, Orchid Room of the Botanical Garden, New York Stock Exchange Trading Floor, the Angelica, preferably the German Expressionist series, but anything with subtitles will do. I shrug and open the envelope, thrilled to discover that despite only working 2 hours, she's paid me for the whole day. The envelope is a major perk of being a nanny. Traditionally, we're kept off the books and dealt with strictly in cash, which always keeps me hoping she'll stick in an extra 20. A girl I knew lived in with a family whose father slipped a few $100 under her door whenever his wife drank too much and caused a scene. It's like waiting tables. You just never know when the customer might be overwhelmed with appreciation. Caitlin? Hi, I'm Nanny, I say. Mrs. X told me that my colleague is blonde and Australian, which makes her fairly easy to pick out amid the sea of faces that have had work done and the faces that are doing the work. I recognize her from the X's photo session in the park. She looks up from where she sits on the school steps, sensibly outfitted in an Izod shirt and jeans, a sweatshirt tied round her waist. She's holding Grayer's apple juice in her right hand with the straw already in it. I'm impressed. Just as she stands to return my greeting, our charge and his classmates are released by his teacher, and the courtyard becomes instantly animated. Grayer comes streaking through the crowd toward Caitlin, but screeches to a halt when he sees me, his enthusiasm visibly draining out through his keds. Grayer, Nanny'll be coming to the park with us this afternoon. Won't that be fun? I sense from her tone that she isn't quite convinced we're in for a laugh riot. He's always a bit cranky when school lets out, but he gets over it fine once he's had his snack, I'm sure. It is chaos around us as children are snacked and playdates are made. I'm impressed by the finesse with which she works Grayer from snack to stroller to goodbyes. He maintains screaming conversation with three of his classmates while getting a sweater put on, a baggie opened, homework unpinned from his lapel, and a stroller strapped under him. She's like a puppeteer keeping the play in motion. I debate taking notes. Right hand on stroller handle, left hand pull down sweater, two steps left and squat. We head toward the park as they chatter away. She propels him forward with ease, though he can't be a light load with his sand toys, school stuff, and backup supplies of snack. "Grayer, who's your best friend at school?" I ask. "Shut up, stupid head," he says, kicking out at my shins. I walk the remainder of the way well outside his field of stroller vision. After lunch, Caitlin takes me around to meet the other nannies in the playground, most of whom are Irish, Jamaican, or Filipino. They each give me a quick, cold appraisal, and I get the sense I won't be making a lot of friends here.
"So what do you do during the week?" she asks, suspiciously.
"I'm a senior at NYU," I say.
I couldn't figure out how she found someone who only wanted to work weekends.
"What? Weekends what?" She reties her ponytail while she continues.
"I do it, but I wait tables on the weekends, and really, one needs a bit of a break by Friday. I thought they had a girl who worked weekends in the country, but I guess she didn't work out. Are you planning on driving out with them to Connecticut on Friday nights or taking the train?"
She looks pointedly at me as I stare back at her in confusion. Then it is suddenly clear to both of us why we aren't meant to discuss the transition. I'm not the pinch hitter. I'm the replacement. A sadness flickers over her features. I reach to change the subject.
"So what's with the card?"
"Oh, that grotty old thing," she swallows. "He carries it everywhere. He'll be wanting it pinned to his trousers and in his pajamas. It drives the missus crazy, but he refuses to so much as put on his underpants without it." She blinks a few times and then turns away. We make it full circle back to the sandbox where another family, who I assume from their matching shell suits and overwhelming zest for life are tourists, is playing.
"He's so cute. Is he your only child?"
the mother asks in a flat Midwestern accent. "I'm 21. He's 4. "No, I'm his..."
"I told you to get out of here, you bad woman!"
Grayer hurls his stroller at me, screaming at the top of his lungs. Blood rushes to my face as I retort with false confidence, "You!"